Maddie, what you just said to me is, if you're still in costume, stay in costume.
Well, I'm just explaining to Riley that Halloween's an incredible time to realize that you need to transition your gender. Mm-hmm. And it's true. Halloween was yesterday at recording time, but it's Friday night and there's still time to get in drag once and feel the back of your brain on fire.
There is still time
to dress up for Halloween.
Yeah, I'm painting that in like fluorescent chalk on the street outside your house just in case you're in any doubt about this.
Yeah, well, it's Friday night. I could get to the club and maybe I could try on some different costumes.
You're going to go back to the club?
But ultimately,
yes.
Ultimately.
I think your 1 year of transition entitles you to plow through the ridges of my Amazonian mind.
my transsexual mind.
Dear listener, what's happened here is you are hearing the, I would say, last 5% of the conversation that I have with Maddie in November now pretty much weekly.
Yeah, I mean, this is it just happens naturally, right? We sit down to record and we don't start recording immediately. Like, usually Maddie and I all need to talk to each other for about a half an hour about, like, Oreos first.
That's right.
Yeah, what's your Oreo conversation that you've been
my
having?
Oreo conversation is that we are drift compatible for Oreos because I don't I don't like the stuff inside the Oreo. I like the like biscuit, but not the filling.
Yeah, and I like the filling, but I love to twist off the top and have one open-faced bottom Oreo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the Scandinavian Oreo or the Oreo.
Yeah, we're gonna sit cross-legged on the floor in the Swedish style, and we're gonna each twist off the part of the Oreo and we're going to feed it to each other through crossed arms.
Mm, yeah, yeah, yeah.
What you're suggesting is you're going to eat Oreos so hedonically efficiently that you're going to actually be able to double the overall utiles that you're able to enjoy from one bag of Oreos. Yeah,
previously, I was just like twisting off the Oreos, scraping the like goop off them. You know, it was like sort of borderline agricultural labor, right? I was coming in from the field with a big bushel of like, you know, half Oreos.
Yeah. You're scraping the goo into your corded ware culture pot.
Exactly, exactly. You know, and people theorize.
Riley just clapped like a child at the zoo.
Look, if you're a few ways, reliable ways to get me to clap. Mentioning Kurgans, mentioning the corridor, mentioning the Bell Beaker horizon.
That's right.
Riley, have you ever considered going back to school for anthropology?
No, why?
Have you considered ever standing outside Patrick Wyman's house with a boombox?
What, trying to get him to transition?
Yeah, that's right.
Uh-huh. You could be the world's foremost transsexual expert on like Mayan step pyramids if you wanted to be. You don't have to be a podcaster.
Yeah. They haven't yet banned trans women from the Mayan ball game.
getting my head cut off and I'm being like, damn, this is so funny. Yeah.
I'm walking to the big stele in Tenochtitlan.
Oh my God.
Where they like advertise all of the opinions. And then this one lady whose father is like a temple priest and is in charge of like 50 hectares of cornfields. And she never says that, by the way. Like, it doesn't matter that like her parents' link on the informational giant stone stele is blue.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Right?
Uh-huh. They paint the special ones blue to indicate their ritual significance.
Yeah, that's right. It's just, and
yeah, is that her father is profiting off flour and Star Wars? It's, you know. Yeah.
Well, this one who hosts Query Hour at the... as has actually said to a temple priest who wanted to be a little bit more generous with the corn redistribution, was like, oh, are you going to nationalize llama sausages?
You're going to nationalize maize?
You're going to nationalize maize? Anyway, that opinion writer on the big stele at the front of the temple pyramid, she's like making a whole bunch of like complaints now about you capture women in the women's flower war and make them fight, but actually a bunch of the people that you're capturing in the women's flower war were born as men, and it actually means that, you know, the sacrifice is not considered a rite. It's not considered by Quetzalcoatl to actually be ritually significant.
the woke temple priests are like, you know, using my pronouns.
Imagine the cover of Irreversible Damage, but it's the Mayan ball game hoop. Anyways, speaking of history, do you want to start the podcast?
I'm just going to use Google Translate phrase to see if I can find the Nahuatl pronunciation of what is a woman.
Okay. Yeah. Please do that briefly.
Translate.
Mm-hmm.
Nahuatl.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's going to Google's Translate.
No, it's going into a Lingo Jam Aztec translator by Nopalston.
Okay.
This is a very Web 1.0 site.
Uh-huh. Beautiful. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. This is great radio.
Mm-hmm. Tlenkasi Seattle. And that was asked by the Aztec Empire's most hateable temple priest.
Yeah, he paints his beard on with nopal cactus thorns.
Yeah, it's really embarrassing how Aztec Matt Walsh uses guy liner.
Oh my lord!
Okay, we gotta stop.
You can't do this to a second podcast, Riley.
Mm-hmm.
It's my fault, I think.
I can and I will, and I
this
have.
Is gonna like keep happening until he starts a podcast about like Mesoamerica.
Yeah. Mm. Anyways,
that's right.
It can be called Mesoamerica.
Hello, everyone. And welcome
it can be
to
called Making a Mess, Oh America, and I can start it after the
No
Trump
gods,
win.
No mayors. I'm the mayor of this episode. I am Maddie, and I'm joined as ever by my deputy mayors, Nova and Riley. Hello. You two.
Well, you say deputy mayor, it assumes more of a ritual significance, you know?
I'm going to throw you off the top of a stepped pyramid. And it's not going to count because your heart is not beating anymore.
That's going to suck to fall down a step pyramid as well. Because you're getting like a multi-hit combo built up.
You're getting the Homer Simpson in the canyon.
What has essentially happened is that gravity and the earth are doing Penchak Salat to you.
Yeah, whereas if you fall down a Kurgan, like that's fine, you know, or a barrow.
I fall down a Kurgan for fun. That sounds great.
If you're hurled from the Tarpeian Rock, for instance.
Kurgan boarding. It's a, you know, it's an Olympic exhibition sport next year, but it's really difficult to build all the Kurgans in time.
Yeah. It sucks that one Australian just managed to make herself the most important Kurgan boarder in Australia and then like fucked it up on purpose.
Yeah, it's that the Kurgan Association actually was kind of like not really a strong international force, and she was allowed to game the system and just sort of like her husband builds Kurgans or something.
Wait, her husband builds Kurgans. What is her husband? Like a steppe warlord? Yeah, her husband commands like 200 horse, but they count in base 20, so it's like 1,000.
I feel like all the time I'm at a party and I'm like, well, what does that guy do? And you're like, oh, you step warlord, you know?
Step warlord.
Yeah. Get a real job.
Yeah. You can always tell who the step warlord is at a party because the chariot he steps out of is really ornate.
Yeah. Or I hate their TikToks, which is, of course, when they carve what they're doing on a wood board.
We're step warlords. Of course, we burn the entire city to bulldoze it into the river.
We're step warlords. Of course, we use a composite recurve bow that's easy to fire from a horse.
God damn it. Okay, so today...
doing vox pops in Ulaanbaatar with a little microphone.
Sorry, who are we talking about today?
Well, I'll get to who we're talking to in a minute, which is our first mayor of history, which is great because we've been talking, we're already in history mode.
Mm-hmm.
But as tempting it is, I can't go back immediately to the New York City well. So I'm picking someone close to home for me personally, which is, of course, Phineas T. Barnum, who is the mayor of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Inventor of statements that you may find relatable, leading you to trust me because I made them.
That's correct. But he was the mayor of Bridgeport. From the years of 1875 to 1876, late in life.
In this sense, sort of related to a lot of our other mayors and the concept of mayor generally, because he's most famous for kind of administering clowns.
That's right.
Yeah. Would you say he would, Maddie, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go ahead. This is kind of unusual, but yeah, go ahead.
Uh-huh. Would you say that, if P.T. Barnum was to be a mayor of an American city now, that he should be the mayor of Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia?
I don't understand why. Why would that be?
Oh, thank you. Okay. I think I should be clear. Because of the clowns who are in Congress?
Who the mayor is in charge of, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. But I think the people in Congress are actually still technically constituents of where they live, not Washington, D.C. Uh-huh.
Okay.
So I don't quite understand what you're asking.
I really like the idea of doing electoral reform by like keeping everything, but making all of Congress represent D.C. Like every block in D.C. gets like a senator and like two representatives.
In the city state of D.C. and then put a wall around it.
I'm Chuck Schumer. I'm the senator for New York, and also from like 100 square meters.
No, not New York, not New York.
But also no, he gets New York Avenue.
Mm. Yeah, okay. So he's New York State as well as like New York Avenue in D.C. And it's like you get whatever bit is most associated.
No.
Okay,
you just get D.C. Right? Sole constituency. And then the rest of the U.S. is administered by step warlords, of course.
So you're saying like basically what you're talking about is like when the Roman Senate moved to Ravenna.
To form a more equitable society.
No. That didn't happen till later. This was going to Ravenna. And then basically only administered Ravenna. Is what you're talking about.
Yes. Well, I'm talking about the fascist Italian Social Republic, where they administered like a tiny bit of northern Italy and they made the movie Salo about it. Yeah, that, yeah.
Okay, I see. All right, that clears it up for me. Thank you.
Good, I'm glad.
I was in the bathroom. What happened? Anyways, before we get started, I'd like to introduce a new segment that we are calling Municipal Roundup. It's just some recent goofs, floops, and bloops from around the mayoral globe. First, our friend and yours, Rudolph Giuliani, or as I call him, Julie.
Friggin' Giuliani.
I'm reading here from a CNN article. Rudy Giuliani must give control of luxury items and Manhattan apartment to Georgia election workers he defamed. Judge rules.
I love this shit. I cannot get enough of it. More punishments like this from the judicial system, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've given him the Jerry Seinfeld, you have to be his butler.
Yeah, you falsely accused like three women of like doing electoral fraud, and now they just have your apartment.
They just have you have to sell your apartment and give them the money.
I don't think you should be allowed to sell it. I think they should have to live in that apartment.
They also have to live in it.
All three of them together, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And then Rudy has to like be their like singing butler.
Yes.
Well, 4 days a week.
He has to like contribute like life lessons in like a heartwarming way to relate to their like, you know, weekly storylines.
He has to be their Mrs. Doubtfire.
He's got to get in drag.
We've already seen him do it. Like,
oh, yeah, he's become a beautiful woman again.
My court ordered drag queen butler.
Yeah. Yeah, he's or like he has to, I think he should, it's not enough that like he has to just like sell all this stuff to pay them. I agree with you, November.
I'm curious about the luxury items. What items is he being deprived of?
So it appears that the items are a collection of several watches.
Which again, they will be wearing.
Yeah, including ones given in by European presidents after September 11th.
So you can always remember what time it is.
That's right. It's 9/11 time.
I would love to know what any of the watches were. Like, were any of them just like a Mickey Mouse time?
That's right. Given to you. Yeah, given to him by the president of Italy.
Mr. Mayor Berlusconi has given you a swatch.
It's very valuable.
Mr. Mayor, the president of Andorra has given you a watch with candy inside.
You know, I have way fewer watches with candy inside now than I used to.
That's true.
Because you ate all the candy?
Like, if you graph the number of watches with candy inside in my life, it was like a spike in my kind of childhood years and then like down to zero for the rest of it. I think it's a grave shame.
I mean, I think you can tell the world's a lot worse for it. I think that was we could trace it back to that. A signed Joe DiMaggio jersey, another sports memorabilia.
Which they'll be wearing. They'll be wearing the signed Joe DiMaggio jersey while they're living in the flat.
They're making him sell his signed Joe DiMaggio jersey like Kinds of Kindness.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And because it is a New York rich guy, he of course has to be a weird bitch for some reason. And the last thing is he has to turn over a Mercedes-Benz that was owned by Lauren Bacall.
That's the gayest thing I've heard in my fucking life.
No, that, so this is the thing, is if you are from New York City, you are a little gay because you're into musical theater. So it makes you a little
like Trump.
Like yeah. Trump, who's like a failed musical theater producer.
Mm-hmm.
But all these guys who are like, there's a, like, you'll, a thing around here is you'll just see a very, very tough guy and he's got a very little dog and he loves the Man of La Mancha. And it's just like, these are tough things to do and be.
Tough guys don't dance, but they do drive around in Lauren Bacall's Mercedes.
I was half expecting the next item on this list to be like a cigarette holder that was used by Audrey Hepburn. Yeah. I'd like to revise my earlier punishment. Rather than Giuliani having to dress like as Mrs. Doubtfire and like work for these ladies, I think he should be forbidden from dressing in drag. I think that would be a worse punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. You've really been able to get into his mind there, Riley. That's interesting.
Hey.
Anyways, he's also got some other stuff. Like he's got a Yankees World Series ring. But they're like, maybe he has to give that up.
All of this stuff is stuff that Howie would have had in Uncut Gems. All of this except for the Lauren Bacall Mercedes. Everything else Howie would have had in Uncut Gems.
Yeah. Yeah, he would have like, you know, like Patrick Ewing's Mercedes. But he's also, yeah, he has to also pay like $2 million in fees to these women. It's insane that his life continues to get worse. We don't, obviously, this is coming out after the election. I don't know how that's going to go. But he appeared at Trump's big fascism rally.
I've been making predictions, but like scattershot, like I've done one in, I think, every direction possible on different podcasts.
Okay.
So let me just throw one in here. You know, it's crazy that Rudy Giuliani is president now.
That's right.
Didn't see that, you know.
Yeah. My only prediction, and I made this on Twitter the other day, is no matter what the outcome of this upcoming election is, I know the 2028 election will be a Joe Biden, Donald Trump rematch, no matter what. And they're both going to be carried around like mummified Sapa Incas.
The romance between those two men is so strong. I want to see, you know, fuck this like Will Ferrell shit. I want to see a movie or like a show about those two driving across America in Lauren Bacall's Mercedes. I think that could heal country. You know, I think that's the real like rally to restore sanity. I think Americans have more in common than they think they do.
Yeah.
You know, and these two weird, racist, slightly gay old men can probably like demonstrate that to them.
That's correct.
I have a different thing, which is I think instead of doing a show where they travel across America, I think they should recreate famous movie scenes together, starting, of course, with De Niro and Pacino in Heat at the diner.
They should be doing a calendar of classic movie scenes, like the dogs at the end of Best in Show.
I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart. By the way, you've completely fucked me here by mentioning Lauren Bacall's Mercedes, because I'm focusing in on it as a kind of like tulpa. Right, I'm rotating a kind of like olive green, like W170 Mercedes in my head for some reason. And it won't stop.
That's beautiful. Next up in Municipal Roundup is a man I'm told is called Eric Adams. Things continue to nosedive for our friend and former guest. Last we left him, the NYPD commissioner and evil twin brother of an evil twin brother, Edward Caban, had just stepped down in September. His replacement, interim commissioner Tom Donilon, has also now said he is stepping down.
Uh-huh. He wants to give everyone a go.
Yeah. I got a beautiful sentence from a political article here. Not long after Donilon accepted the commissioner job, federal agents also searched his home. And also, Donilon, who served as an FBI agent before becoming NYPD commissioner, said at the time those materials, quote, came into my possession 20 years ago and are unrelated to my work with the department.
Uh-huh.
At press time, he's still in the office. But it appears once a replacement is secured, he too is.
Is he in the office or in the secret office?
Because yeah, he's in the regular office at One Police Plaza, I assume. Though maybe there's secret offices in the building. I don't know.
And down the street at Two Police Plaza, because they'll never think to look there. one not Police Plaza.
Two Police Plaza is just a plain clothes building.
It's the cross street.
Yeah, that's where you have to work after you leave, is you go from One Police Plaza to One Not Police Plaza.
Yeah.
One, legally, you have to tell me if you're the Police Plaza.
Yeah, it's a big building that's wearing like Levi's jeans, white trainers.
It's got
and,
like a
sort
badge
of,
print in one of the pockets. Yeah, it's like,
and like a New York Yankees hat with like a Jason Bourne type jacket, and it's just standing around with his phone and a cell phone in a holster for some reason. That's and it's right. just chilling.
I do like at least two of those things a lot of the time. So yeah. like, let's not be too quick to judge here.
Yeah. A bunch more people have entered the fray for mayor. Who's we got like a Bloomberg style technocrat in the race now, and also Ooh. an actual factual socialist, Zoran Mamdani, who will probably get assassinated by the NYPD if he wins.
Yeah, I saw his ad. It was good.
Yeah, he's good. He's my local guy.
I don't like his font.
You're anti-Zoran's font.
Everybody thinks since like AOC, you gotta have a font, you know, and it's like font first. You gotta have the cool font and you gotta have the cool like word mark, and everybody's gonna like follow from that. But you know, I've been burned by fonts before, and I don't like the kind of like the dual color thing. It's like red and yellow, like a McDonald's.
Okay. Mayors should stop like editing the spacing and the kerning and like the margins on their papers and just write the whole thing. This stuff at the start. Like, just write the paper. Sorry, please go ahead.
Yeah, Eric Adams was spotted wearing a very funny hat with both the Mets and Yankees logo on it, and it made everybody mad.
That was awesome. That I was loved that so hat. Good.
That was the perfect expression of Eric Adams.
He had the X in the middle like it was a collab between the two, which makes it significantly funnier than the last time this happened, which was Rob Lowe from the West Wing going to the Super Bowl and watching wearing just a hat that just said NFL on it.
Yeah, that's like, because you know why? Because that's fundamentally, okay, that's a conservative hat. That's like, I like this institution. I support the institution. I love the rules. I think Roger Goodell's great, and I love him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas I think what Eric Adams is doing is something much more radical, where he's saying, what if, like, starting in New York, the city where, like, the America chooses to link and build, right? What if the Yankees and the Mets got together and then they could like reinvent baseball as a more cooperative, like entrepreneurial sport.
That's right.
And you know, it's if they work together, how many runs could they get?
Yeah.
Right.
I have a related thing to this, which is something we didn't cover in the episode, which is another piece of local New York journalism, which is that a journalist called Jeff Colton walked into City Hall wearing a Brooklyn Dodgers hat and got yelled at by Eric Adams for wearing a Boston hat. So. Because he saw the B and he was like, for Boston, I assume.
The B means Boston.
No, I know, I have insider knowledge. I know what happened here is that Eric Adams had just come from a ribbon cutting ceremony in Little Boston.
you know, New York is the Boston of New York.
Well, sorry, Little Boston.
Yeah, that's good. I was trying to find whether or not Eric Adams was a Mets fan or a Yankees fan. And I found an old quote. From 2022 in the New York Post. It goes, I'm so glad the boys of summer are coming back. The self-proclaimed Mets fans told reporter during an unrelated press conference in the Bronx on Friday. I hope in the next year we start seeing the boys and the girls of summer. It's time to allow women to play professional baseball as well. Which I say, slay. Thank you, Eric Adams. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Beautiful.
I think Eric Adams' most like prescient adjective there is unrelated, you know? He said at an unrelated press conference. It's that unprompted best captures the essence of Eric Adams.
That's
you know?
Correct.
Yeah. Like, what on earth was this press conference about? Like,
I don't know.
Like sanitation.
Yeah, probably. Like,
Mayor Adams, what are you planning on doing about the fact that most of the city's garbage trucks are now on fire?
Yeah.
And he'd be like, first of all,
I think it's time for women to play baseball.
Why don't they have a they thems of summer?
Yeah, I think Eric Adams can only give quotes in the sort of click hole style, which is just Eric Adams, comma, unprompted. So a couple more things. He's got some more people related to him accused of fraud, both in an EB-5 investment scandal with people's visas that he was doing some scamming. And then also there was a protege of his that was working on these multimillion-dollar leases with what's the name of the Department of Citywide Administrative Services, which is like that's who like figures out where city offices are going to go. And that guy was taking bribes as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, the amount of money the NYPD had to give him to get one police plaza, you know?
That's right.
That was going to go to sanitation. It would have been a whole thing, you know?
Look, it's through a complicated series of bribes. The police are now headquartered at one sanitation plaza. The garbage men are now headquartered at one police plaza. The teachers, weirdly, are at City Hall, and City Hall's in Staten Island. Yeah. But everyone's rich. Everyone's got a Lamborghini.
It's 2024. Policemen are now garbage men. Streets are now battlefields.
Police officers and garbage men should switch names.
That's great. Those, he got booed at the New York Liberty Championship Parade, and the mascot made him hold her purse while she danced, which was beautiful.
Incredible.
Ugh, women, am I right?
Yeah, and then one last thing on Eric Adams is it turns out those rat-proof bins are merely rat-resistant because they can chew through them.
Listen, I mean, I'm never going to hold it against him for underestimating a New York City rat, you know? Like, those, they evolve faster than people can develop a bin.
That's right. And then last up on our municipal roundup is thanks to Alex Hennessy in the Patreon comments, we were turned on to the incredible existence of a reality show called Tarana, also sometimes called Wingmen, which was a passion project of the owner of the Wild Wing restaurant, Rick Smiklis, who is, of course, yes! not to be confused with Michael Kiklis.
Uh-huh.
So it's Wing Tarana was a mockumentary.
Yes.
Like an Office style mockumentary, but about like owning a chain of wing stores.
They should have cast Michael Checklist.
What to like be a sort of corrupt wing store owner?
It's not Checklist nor Kickless, it's Smiklis. Please.
That's the third way.
Yeah.
Neither Kickless nor Checklist.
But he was good friends with Mr. Ford, apparently, so he makes a couple of appearances.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen some videos. I've seen a video of Rob Ford lumbering out of a muscle car.
He lumbers into a muscle car in this one that I saw.
I watched it in reverse then, like fucking.
You watched the Saudi version.
Like Jamal Khashoggi, yeah.
The license plate of Rob's Mustang is, of course, Tarana.
Uh-huh.
Where they just like peel out and then go to a parking lot. Where Rick then gives a guy a bag full of 100 grand. It's just
so much like Rob Ford's real life.
I know.
It's just like meeting guys in muscle cars in parking lots and exchanging bags of money.
Yeah, we'll put the video in the show notes. It's really beautiful.
What I like most about this clip is that like Rob Ford looks like he is dying because I guess he is.
This is so,
yeah.
It's like Bushido, but for Maz, you know, you still make the weird thing.
Yeah, he has tagged rhinoceros at this point in his life. Like he's...
He is terminally ill at this point because he's been mayor and is no longer mayor by the time this is released. Because he suspended his campaign. He's like, I have terminal cancer. And so like, this is in 2015 when he does this. He's like fucking, he's on his way out. And he
made the time because it was important to him.
Because he can't stop.
Michael Bitchless or whatever was like a make a wish kid to him. You know, he was like, I have to make this like Wingstop owner's like dreams come true. You know, he needs to see me like awkwardly climb into a like a Mustang.
Once he sees me lumber, he'll never be the same.
So one of Rob Ford's last living acts was to do a press conference for Rick Smiklis's chicken wing film. And this is from a Vice article from 2015. Although Smiklis said that Ford would only be taking a few questions, the former mayor has always been a talker. After answering some questions from what seemed to be a conservative bloggers and or yes men in the audience, and I would love to have heard what those questions are. What have you written your Oscar acceptance speech already for Wingmen? Your friend Michael Rick Smiklis says, I cut and asked the question that had been burning me for the whole night. Rob, with all the stuff that's happened in the last couple of years, continuing with politics, despite the fallout from being mayor, do you ever think this is going to affect your health? Why do you keep doing it? Ford said, I just don't think of my cancer. They say to go home and relax, but that's not my nature. It's to get out there and help people. If people call, I'm at their front door. It's about customer service, and I sincerely love my job.
He was like actually flatlining, trying to hand the crash team his business cards.
He's throwing wads of business cards at them. This is canonical.
Just like, if you need anything from me, he's like with his last breaths, with his last action, raising the supreme money gun filled with business cards and spraying the fucking palliative care facility.
Oh my God.
It's like his last act was to call someone a racial slur and then fire one business card at them.
just the one like South Asian worker at the hospice. Just experiencing an emotional roller coaster in like a minute of like, holy shit, is that the former mayor? Did he just call me a slur? Is that a business card? Is he dead now?
I was also browsing Rob's IMDb page to see if there are more episodes he was on, which he has one. He's on another episode of Wingmen simply called Toronto, the synopsis of which is Rick goes to Chicago to help out his cousin Mickey, who may or may not be terminally ill.
Mickey Chickless?
Rick and Mick Smickless cousins.
Michael Chickless and Paul Kickless.
The third brother, Nick, you know?
Yeah. The synopsis of the actual show was just incredible to me because he sounds like very, very Freudian as well, which is the true life story of Rick Smickless, a successful purveyor of chicken wings who turned $100 into a 100-store chicken wing chain only to lose it all. There's also, they forgot to put a comma between Smickless and so just in the synopsis. So it's the true life of Rick Smickless, a successful purveyor of chicken wings, which is just beautiful IMDb work.
So that, but there's, so I'm sorry we have to, I know we have to talk about the real mayor for this one.
That's right.
But the last thing is, that episode, it was only in the one episode of this show, because that was all the same episode. Somehow, is that Ford lends Rick Smickless the muscle car in order to help Mick Smickless, who's European. First, he was like his cousin, his European cousin, Mick Smickless.
Oh, my European, it's pronounced Smikla, where he's from.
Basically, he gives, and then like, but he's just doing his normal Rob Ford thing, where he like hears someone needs something, and he's like, drives over to give them a muscle car, except a pile of money, and then wander off into a parking lot.
God,
that's
100%
of Ford's appearance in the film, and then he was in the press conferences about it. Okay. Rob Ford.
Get along, little mayors. Okay.
So get along, little mayor.
It's been half an hour of this, so let's dig in. We fucked up.
To be clear, the research for this, you read a whole book.
I listened to most of an audiobook of P.T. Barnum's life to try and get some fucking insight on this guy. And let me tell you, he is a mystery man. So anyways, let's dig in.
I don't know. I loaned him some money and I'm pretty sure he's going to be good for it.
That's right. We'll get to that.
I pointed to the minor city position of Wallet Inspector.
So here's the thing about P.T. Barnum, right? In my research of him, he was, of course, a con artist and was very good at separating people from their money, but he was really, really committed to people getting an entertainment return on it in a way that a lot of other of his contemporaries were just trying to bilk people. And his big, like, bugaboo his entire life was, like, people not promise or, like, not following through on their promises for entertainment. And he would, like, get into lawsuits and shit over this because he's like, the people should be actually entertained while I steal their money and lie to them and exploit people.
It's a sacred trust, you know?
Yeah.
Was P.T. Barnum like a sort of a fae figure or a demon?
I think he occupied like a community role that was evil, but that like had a code, like a, yes, like a moneylender or a vampire, you know?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
P.T. Barnum thinks clowns are funny.
That's right. Wow. I believe he actually thinks everything. He actually is kind of a Joker-esque figure, in which the other thing I found is that he loves practical jokes, and he's like always like his fondest memory of is like his grandfather, who like he was very close to, and like he was born a landowner because his grandfather bestowed him land immediately, but the land was like unusable and shitty, and he's like, and that was my grandpa's first prank on me. And he loves it. So he was born in Bethel, Connecticut, which is near Bridgeport, outside in 1810. His father Philo ran an inn, and his maternal grandfather and namesake, and according to P.T.'s autobiography, a big influence on him, yeah. He was a sort of like larger-than-life guy. P.T. described him as, quote, a great wag. There's some really good phrases in here.
Wait, and what? Was he like dating Wayne Rooney?
Yeah, he was dating Wayne Rooney.
The P in P.T. stands for Philo?
It's Phineas. His father was Philo.
Oh, I see.
And when I say the sentence, it's Phineas, his father was Philo, every single one of those F sounds is a PH. I want you to imagine that in your mind's eye. Yeah, he got willed a useless swamp called Ivy Island from his grandpa, who also was apparently a guy who ran local lottery schemes.
Another community figure of evil, the numbers guy.
The numbers runner.
Mm.
When PT was 15, his father died. And he began his...
We can't keep calling him PT every time. It makes me think of the boat.
Sorry, should I call him? What should we call him? Phineas?
Yes, okay. I guess so.
When Phineas T. Barnum was 15, his father died. We'll call him Barney. And he began his long life of the entrepreneur.
I'm really stuck on P.T. Boat Barnum. That's it would have been a pretty decent screen name on Twitter like 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah. Like someone whose last tweet is 2014 and you're like, but they were so funny.
They were so funny.
I can't believe that P.T. Boat Barnum got like killed by the cops after like trying to attack them with a sword, you know? Like he had some good posts.
Yeah, either they attack the cops and die that way, or they reemerge 10 years later and they were trans. That's the only route for that kind of poster. So congratulations, P.T. Boat Barnum, on your transition.
Or commiserations on your suicide by cop.
Is that like a card you can get, you know, like congratulations on your suicide by cop, and on the cover it's a bunch of like that style of cartoon work of just like terrified cops blazing away with Glocks.
So according to I missed
that genre of tweet so much too as well. The like, you know, Eagle Stouts breakdancing type shit. I have a real weakness for it. Whenever I see it, I'll retweet it. And then whenever I do, I'm like, damn, it's crazy that guy like, you know, got killed in Botswana or something.
That's right.
It's weird that guy was killed by mortar fire. It's weirder that it happened in Indiana.
In my research, I ended up a lot on the circusringoffame.org biography of the man. But anyways,
circusringoffame.org
as opposed to the Circus Ring of Infamy, which is like designed for the circus's scoundrels.
that's the people that charge the money but don't provide the entertainment. Mm. Also, I just love that it's circusringoffame.org as opposed to like .com.
Yeah,
well, because it's a foundation, you know,
it's a foundation. So he was at this point he owned already at 15 a general store, a book auctioning trade, and had a hand in real estate speculation.
Kids these days just don't want to work.
That's right.
The 19th century Forbes 15 under 15.
It's a short list.
It's a short list.
Practically so.
Yeah. He also ran a statewide lottery at this point. And at the age of 19, he started a newspaper called The Herald of Freedom. And he was writing a lot of editorials about the elders of local churches.
It's this kind of Charles Foster Kane shit, you know? Like, yeah. I think it might be fun to run a newspaper.
Right, and Connecticut is, like, old Yankee country, right? Mm. And there's a lot of, like, the state should be, like, run by the church, and that's fine. And he was writing a lot of op-eds saying, like, we should, what about the separation of church and state? Because it's 1829, and he was imprisoned for libel for 2 months for this.
A place where there actually still can be city fathers and where they can just throw you in jail.
That's right. At 24, he sold his general store.
Just narrowly missed being the object of the lottery, Shirley Jackson style.
At 25, he did his first act of weird and evil exploitation.
Is that how he describes it?
That's how I describe it, because he bought the scare quotes exhibition of a blind and almost paralyzed black slave woman named Joyce Heff, who was an acquaintance of his, was exhibiting her around Philadelphia, saying she was George Washington's former nurse and 161 years old. Slavery was illegal in New York, where P.T. wanted to do, the P.T. Boatman wanted to exhibit her, but a loophole allowed him to lease the woman for $1,000 a year.
Jesus Christ.
Phineas worked her 10 to 12 hours a day and hosted, which killed her, obviously.
Yeah.
And then, of course, hosted a live autopsy of her body at a saloon in New York.
Oh my God!
Where he did he's evil. He's an evil man.
I don't want to do historical mares anymore.
Stop the ride. But you know,
take us back to the goofy mayors.
Yeah, he's pretty goofy. The circus comes up later. We know clowns and stuff, elephants.
Uh huh.
This is also like part of his weird, I think. His whole thing, right, is he hosts this autopsy and says, see, she's been a fraud all along and I proved it, because she was only 80 years old at the time. That was what the autopsy determined. But it's this thing that he keeps doing his whole life, which is that he like has these exquisite frauds and draws people in, and then he himself proves them wrong and is like, wasn't that fun?
So he was what, kind of like a 19th century Penn Jillette?
Like, kind of, honestly. And right down to like him hating spiritualists and like suing them and stuff.
He R.I.P. P.T. Barnum, you would have loved Reddit.com.
Yeah, he would have. Yeah, I mean, but he's basically like an influencer is how he functions. In New York around this time, also, there's a thing called the American Museum, which was built under Mayor Alert, the Tammany Society.
Uh-huh. Love those guys. Future big guests. Fan. Friend of the show.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm filing that under future mayors.
Future mayors and future guests. We're going to get them on to describe, like, to, you know, for something unrelated because we're friends with them.
With the nightmare.
Yeah. Mm. No, we're going to have the Tammany Society on. We're going to have the Tammany Society and Andrew Long on and do one more episode of Bones.
You may ask me, what is an American museum? Well, it's the most 1791 shit of all time, which is when they built it, which is like a room full of curiosities and a menagerie.
Yeah, because like museums used to be like old, rich, weird guy with a hoarding problem has a bunch of stuff in his house. And yeah. He will, like, if you slip him like, you know, $5, he will let you in to look at it, which is why a bunch of the oldest museums here are like named after one guy, whether that's, you know, like the Pitt Rivers or whatever the fuck. Like,
yeah, really just the John Soames Museum, which is just, again, like a guy's house, which was full of stuff. And now you can go and see the stuff from this guy's house, which is just still there.
I mean, on that basis, I could start charging admission to this apartment, you know?
Yeah.
If the sole criterion is you've hoarded a bunch of weird shit, you know, like at least none of it's like anthropologically problematic. I don't have any shit I stole from like, you know, Polynesia in here.
Yeah. And you just like stand outside your apartment saying, come look at my stuff. And they give you a dollar.
Yeah, exactly.
What would they come and look at? Just like, this is my office chair.
These are my too many pairs of shoes. You know,
too many pairs of shoes. They all start screaming.
It's the pair of boots that I bought in like the same size that I thought would fit me, and it turned out not to. And I don't really know what to do with them. It's on a pedestal, the plaque that says all of that verbatim.
Yeah. So at this point, 31-year-old Barnum in 1841. Buys the attraction, which is then owned by a guy called Scudder. It is Scudder's American Museum at this point, but he renames it Barnum's American Museum.
I would love to go to Scudder's American Museum.
Yeah.
And be horrified
at the lamb with two heads that they had.
Yeah.
But he renames it Barnum's American Museum. And this is like, you know, contrary, like the circus only comes up way later in his life. Like for most of his life, he is famous for his museum. That is his thing that he is famous for.
P.T. Barnum, American exhibitionist.
That's right. So,
I couldn't think of the word for a museum guy. Yeah, curator.
Curator. So this is also a couple years into the Panic of 1837, which is a major depression that lasts well into the 1840s. So people were like looking for cheap entertainment, and he had just a weird house where you can go look at a bison. Isn't that crazy? Mm.
I want to talk about what he did to promote the American Museum, because he really didn't want to let you walk past the American Museum.
No.
But he kind of invented like a lot of early marketing, right?
Yeah, he put a lighthouse on the roof, shining up and down the street.
But what do you want, boats to crash into it?
You want a PT boat to crash into it?
Would have been the 19th century 9/11, a boat crashing into a museum in New York City.
Some of those scurrilous Barbary pirates.
19 brave Ottoman Empire hijackers have seized control of a schooner.
No, it would be 19 Barbary corsairs have seized control of the Queen Mary, and they've decided to plow it through Lower Manhattan. Yeah. To get the American Navy out of the Mediterranean.
I was reading like contemporaneous stuff about like how they were getting people to the museum. And they were like, everyone was like, here, he did something really crazy. He put a bunch of flags all over it and that drew the eye.
Huh.
It's like it's just one of those things where it's like, oh man.
No one thought to do this before.
No one thought to put a flag on that building that said, come inside.
Mm.
So
it's the keys are jingling before my very eyes.
He got to do all of the most obvious stuff.
Yes.
First.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he actually invented the concept of a sign.
Yeah, I mean, basically. But then he gets creative, right? In 1842, he introduces the famous Fiji mermaid, which was the head and torso of a, quote, blue monkey, which was most likely a baboon, attached to the tail of a large fish, most likely a salmon.
Oh, just start sewing shit together like the human centipede.
Truly, but apparently this is a very popular thing that was sold to sailors in like the Pacific. This was bought in most likely in Japan or Jakarta, which is crazy because I looked up and it said they paid $5,000 or $6,000 for it. which is the like 150 grand today, which
that's
is crazy.
That's so awesome.
Just to pay for a skeleton.
Yeah, you could buy like, you could get like Lauren Bacall's Mercedes for that.
Yeah.
Well, P.T. Barnum did suggest that some of the Blue Dog Democrats from Georgia were in fact, you know, miscounting votes in a way that was like not even allowed by 19th century standards. And so had to give the three spinster aunts control of his Fiji mermaid.
That's right.
There we go. I got there.
The Fiji mermaid was living in a Boston museum. There's a sort of Boston P.T. Barnum named Moses Kimball. But he rented it from him.
Second P.T. Barnum with a worse accent.
Every city seemed to have a P.T. Barnum at this time, basically. But he was just the most successful P.T. Barnum and absorbed most of the other guys.
Yeah. And then Boss Tweed came out and was like, P.T. Barnum is the Moses Kimball of the Boston of America.
Well,
here
of course,
in New York.
Of course, Boss Tweed had a Boston equivalent. Boston Tweed.
Yeah, so Boss Tweed being sort of lithographed, walking around his son's room saying something as simple as a laudanum bottle.
Why am I envisioning a top hat with the Yankees and Mets logos embroidered
That's
onto the front of
tremendous.
It?
Tremendous.
Can we sell those? Do we know anyone who makes a top hat?
Yeah. If you make, I normally say don't write in, but if you make top hats, write in.
Yeah, if you are an honest to God haberdasherer or a milliner, excuse me, if you're an honest to God milliner,
thank you,
and you're willing to embroider a top hat for the fans of this show, an Abraham Lincoln stovepipe hat that has the Yankees and the Mets collaborating on it, then yeah. I think we could invent the most confusing and upsetting garment of all time.
So yeah, here's like the first instance of him doing this, but he never says the hoaxes are real, but he would call them advertisements. A quote from him here is, "I don't believe in duping the public, but I believe in first attracting and then pleasing them," which is very forward.
Doing like pickup artist shit.
Yeah.
What he did is he invented the advertorial, basically.
Yeah.
Mm.
Right? Of like, no, this is actually an advertisement. I'm not saying it's a Fiji mermaid. I'm just saying, look at this Fiji mermaid thing. That's weird. Why don't you come in and enjoy the museum?
Draw your own conclusions about what any of this means.
I think he is interesting as a mayor, which is, we're many years away from him becoming mayor still, but like the idea, this idea of how a politician functions in America is actually very common now. I feel like it's like, we're all supposed to be doing like, what they're saying isn't what they're really saying. What they're saying is a secret thing that they're communicating to me magically.
Mm.
But in the way that like politicians worked at the time was very different. Like it was something you kind of did for a couple of years here and there if you were a businessman or a lawyer, but it was not like a career. But the idea of like politician as showman, I think, is an interesting concept.
Mm. And there's one guy who's still doing this.
That's right.
That's the Donald, you have to say.
A little bit. In 1843, he debuted General Tom Thumb. Real name Charles Stratton, who was then 5 years old, but only 26 inches tall. He was billed as an 11-year-old, and Barnum took him on the tour of the country after teaching him how to do impressions, to sing, to dance, and to mime.
He was on the Forbes 5 Under 5.
This is funny every time. Barnum at this point was in business with Stratton's father, which sounds awesome and normal.
Just like, hey, you got a short son.
Yeah.
You got a little guy, I'll make him famous.
I'm going to take him under my wing, teach him to do my like Irishman act, you know? People will love it.
I'm going to dress him up like Napoleon, for real.
I mean, dressing a short guy up like Napoleon led to like at least one good movie, so.
That's right. He took him on a 3-year tour of Europe, where he met Queen Victoria, and he started to play in a Parisian theater company, and was, for a couple of years, the most famous person alive was Tom Thumb.
Incredible. He had stands.
Yeah, entertainment back then was fucking crazy. It's so cool.
just like back in the day, you're like, I saw a really short kid.
The kid was, guys, really short, and he could dance. The success of the tour allowed Barnum to like buy a bunch more museums and curiosities. And then also while he was on tour, he convinced the Swedish Nightingale, Jenny Lind, to tour America with him. And he made another cool $500,000 off that, which is like $18 million today. But an important thing also about the theater at this time, is that it was considered like a very low art form. Like it was not fancy, right? Like the theater was lumpen. And Barnum is convinced that he himself can get people to take it seriously. So he buys, he builds the biggest theater.
You know what he did? He invented prestige theater. He did prestige TV, but for theaters.
He absolutely did, because he builds the biggest theater in New York City and he calls it the Moral Lecture Room. And he hosts matinees there of a thing called The Drunkard, which is like a temperance lecture disguised as a play.
HBO stands for Home Barnum Office.
For real, it is prestige TV. It's just like thinly veiled moral play about temperance, but like done up fancy. But it does really well. The idea of a daytime play is like a huge hit because people are like, oh my God, I'm not scared of crime during the daytime and I can go into the city.
It's so crazy that everybody thinks that that The Drunkard was about The Drunkard, but actually what's cool is that The Drunkard is more a show about like memory and the false promise of like what America is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I don't really like that one account that's like leftist The Drunkard memes, you know, because yeah. I think they're getting kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, no, it's annoying when everyone's like, oh, I'm like the leftist drunkard. And it's like, no, you're just like saying that because like it's popular.
The drunkard is not like an aspirational character.
No.
Yeah. Everyone thinks the drunkard is like cool because he's in charge.
Yeah.
But like what is he in charge of?
Yeah.
No.
What I hate about it is that it took almost like 10 hours before he finally got a drink.
It's crazy. If you remember, there was that, that one spinster aunt who was like, oh, I just butt-mogged some... I just butt-mogged Tom Thumb. Who was like, oh yeah, I do a leftist...
The sole description of this episode is just going to be no caps, no punctuation, just butt-mogged Tom Thumb.
Anyways, Barnum is at this point very rich. No, I'm talking about P.T. Barnum. We're talking about P.T. Barnum. I'm going to cry on mic. Barnum is now a very rich guy, and he decides that his next big project is to develop the eastern part of Bridgeport, which is where he's got his mansion.
Uh-huh. He's like, I'm sick of living in this swamp.
Yeah, but he's made all his money from his lectures and also dog shows and something called baby contests at the theater.
All of these are, I think you should leave, Ben.
I mean, the baby contest is directly one. Yeah.
Yes.
He issues a massive loan to the Jerome Clock Company to move them to the area he was developing, but they go bankrupt and so does he. This is 1856. He is mired in lawsuits. Everyone is like, loves his downfall, actually. Ralph Waldo Emerson said of this period that his public humiliation, quote, showed the gods visible again, which is some shit to say to some guy you hate.
That's really the riches of his Emersonian mind right there.
That's right.
You know?
He's got a big gaudy mansion at this time called Iranistan.
Okay, uh-huh.
Which is like a uh-huh. Moorish revival. It looks exactly uh-huh. like you think it looks.
Yeah. In Bridgeport did P.T. Barnum a stately pleasure dome decree.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like the state capital from the alternate history novel where the Shriners won World War II.
So look at him with holy dread, for he on booze hath not fed.
But he eventually does another tour of Tom Thumb of Europe, and he himself goes on a lecture tour, mostly speaking on temperance. And by 1860...
They're really playing out the Tom Thumb thing. It's like, oh, Tom Thumb's in Paris now. You know,
he's still short, right? I don't know.
You talking about that Netflix show, Tom Thumb in Paris, that's actually just for Americans?
It's actually pronounced Tommy in Paris.
Yeah, like Eugène Vidocq being like, we are going to get Tom Thumb back to Paris from Rome. We do not think he is having a good time now.
Tom Thumb is the most important young worker at our branding agency in Paris.
People really have like a parasocial relationship with Tom Thumb, and it's really kind of sick when you think about it.
That's,
you know,
right.
The unrealistic expectation.
It's like Tom Thumb is not your real friend.
No.
Right?
No.
It's important to just like let him like, you know, live a normal life as the most famous small child in the world.
Yeah, it was actually very hard for him to get through the plays that he was in back then because people in the audience kept standing up and pointing at him and saying, "It me."
Yeah.
Because that's how it worked back then.
It's like so many people who joined the Silver Standard Party would not have done that if Tom Thumb had just replied to them.
By 1860, Barnum, now 50, is rich again somehow. And he builds a new mansion.
How does that always happen?
These guys just keep getting rich over and over.
You cannot lose. It makes me want to believe in like a Calvinist concept of the elect, you know?
Yeah. The elected mayor.
I mean, yeah, that's basically it.
He expands his museum again and introduces his new Tom Thumb called Commodore Nut.
Oh, there's always another short kid. Yeah. It's really like all about Eve going on in the back in the fucking dressing rooms back there, you know?
He's
like,
doing, what is it, Vertigo to the new kid? It's like I'm giving you a creepy makeover.
Doesn't a general outrank a Commodore anyway? Like, what's the fucking chain of command here?
It's different branches of service.
Tom Thumb has like seniority, you know? He's like hoisting his flag.
Yeah, who's got to salute who when General Tom Thumb and Commodore Nut hang out with each other? And let's never forget that. Oh, and we got
maybe what happened is Tom Thumb got to, and I say this advisedly, big for his boots. And then P.T. Barnum had to remind him there's always a shorter kid. You're not so special. You're replaceable, Tom Thumb.
At least he doesn't outrank me.
Listen, there's short kids lining up out there to get your job, you know?
Yeah, it was so... there was that show about Tom Thumb and his friends like living in New York being celebrities. And everyone thinks that, like, you know, the first couple of seasons, it's all fun. It's like them partying in Iranistan and stuff, you know. But then, you know, in the third season, when they introduce Commodore Nut, then there's actually drama because you're like, oh shit, Tom Thumb's not going to be able to provide a sweet life for Eric Turtle and Johnny Drama either.
So he introduces a bunch more attractions at his museum, including a 7'11" woman named Anna Swan. To which I say hello. He convinced Chang and Ang, the Siamese twins, to come out of retirement. And of course, because he's a weird racist, a guy named Zipped the Pinhead, which I don't like to say.
No.
A man with microcephaly that Barnum invented a new language for and made him speak at the museum.
Just to sort of like break into this here, aside from all the like horrifying human exhibition, Matt was a Conlang guy as well. He was just cooking those up in his spare time.
He was like a Tolkien.
Yeah.
He was like a meaner spirited Tolkien.
I doubt it was that developed.
What if it was? What if it had like an internal grammar, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I hate going to the mayor convention and those guys are insisting to speak to you in
the P.T. Barnum's made up language.
He also, at this time, developed something. I was listening to his autobiography. He developed something that I can only call gorilla madness, in which he is obsessed with getting a gorilla to display live. Like, he's just like, I want to display a gorilla. I want a gorilla. He's like looking around for a gorilla for years. Just like, at this point, nobody has captured a live gorilla, I think. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's too, think about trying to capture a gorilla in the 1850s.
Yeah.
In the 1860s, it's hard.
Yeah, you have like a, I don't know, musket or whatever. Yeah. Meanwhile, the gorilla has its, you know, gorilla powers, same as it does now.
Gorilla power is constant. We already have air power and sea power, but we're ruling with gorilla power. And there's your Dune update for the day.
Let's fucking go.
You need a combined arms force of land and sea power. You need a Commodore commanding multiple ships, transporting troops commanded by the general who will be able to take his beast. Right.
So Barnum hears of a guy who has a gorilla and is like, great, I'll buy your gorilla. And the guy comes with the gorilla and it is a baboon chained to the floor in such a way that it cannot stand up.
Oh, Jesus.
And Barnum's like, hey, man, why can't the... He's not concerned at all, but he's like, hey, no. Why can't this ape stand up? And the guy is like, so no one can see his tail. And Barnum's like, okay, it's a bit of humbug, I guess, right? So he puts the baboon on display, but he writes a letter to a naturalist he knows who's staying in New York that is like one of the only Westerners alive to have seen a gorilla.
Imagine being P.T. Barnum's naturalist.
All right, well, you know, he's a naturalist that he knows.
Imagine being the only naturalist P.T. Barnum has on like in short notice.
You keep getting letters that's just like, hey, is this real? Is this real? How about this one? Is this real?
Well, he gets a letter saying, hey, we got a gorilla in, and much more exciting than the gorillas you've drawn and described, this gorilla has a tail, winky face. So the naturalist comes to the museum. He's like trying to get this naturalist to come to the museum to debunk it in front of everybody. So it's just this weird push and pull that he keeps having, which is like, I'm going to hoax people, but isn't it fun? Isn't it a little winky fun? Like,
that's such an odd thing. That's just like, yeah. So it's like, what, the show is like, yeah, I got hosed by a fake gorilla salesman. you know?
But his point is like, oh, but now you're in the door, right? And you're looking at all the actual cool stuff that is real. Like, that woman's actually 7'11", right?
Uh-huh. And you're saying hello to her.
and you're looking up and you're saying hello.
Mm. Yeah.
But, you know, it's 1864 and the museum is doing great. But there's something called the American Civil War happening.
Yeah, which side of that was P.T. Barnum on?
Barnum is a staunch unionist, and he's an abolitionist, and he's hosting like pro union.
Didn't he have like autopsied a woman that he enslaved?
That's correct, November. But he is at this point in his life a staunch abolitionist. He also, I think, something happened to him in Europe because he came back a teetotaler and an abolitionist.
He saw three ghosts or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Or alternatively, I mean, like, that's the thing with guys like this is they will just, all of their beliefs just flex the world around themselves, right? Yeah. Where all of their beliefs are always consistent all the time.
Yeah, I was always an abolitionist, says guy who likes making money.
He never owned her. He merely, he leased her.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he would say, probably.
Which in many ways makes him like a tenant, which is, you know, an exploitative relationship. Yeah. So,
or also just that, like, he's like, well, no, my job is as an entertainer. I entertain with the stuff that's like available to me to the maximum degree. I don't think that should be available to me, but if it's there, I'll take it.
Yeah, you give me a short kid, I'll put the short kid on a stage. You give me a slave, I'll put the slave on a stage. Yeah. Give me a shorter kid. doing the Oppenheimer thing of until somebody builds a shorter kid.
This kid's so teeny tiny. But who knows how genuine it is, but in all of his writing about himself, all he says is he just wants to make people happy and entertained. Like, that's actually like, on some level, it seems sincere that he does care about that a great deal, that people feel satisfied with what they've seen, you know?
Mm.
But yeah, so he's a staunch unionist. He's got like a former spy for the U.S. government in the South, like lecturing about her escapades. He's got like pro-union exhibits and stuff. And I think a lot of people don't think about this because it seems so, you know, like liberal now, but like New York was actually like a real hotbed of Confederate sympathy.
Mm. The draft riots.
The draft riots, for instance. Like, but if you haven't watched Gangs in New York or read it, or I don't know, like, I think just people, it kind of gets elided a bit in history. But New York had a lot of Confederate sympathizers in it, and one of them burned the fucking museum down.
Well, just like, fuck you and your giant lady and your little boy and your mermaid.
That's right.
Yeah.
But then he rebuilds it because he's still rich, and that one burns down too.
Uh-huh.
So same guy again.
Yeah. I think that one was more of a freak accident, but then he's like...
existed in a cat and mouse existence with the Confederate arsonist. Just a mischievous guy dressed in gray wool with a lot of matches.
It's the Confederate arsonist. Another guy killed by mortar fire. That's a pretty good post.
Oh yeah, it was weird. He like joined the like State Department Diplomatic Security Bureau and then died in Benghazi. It was like, what was he doing out there?
You know, but he was at this time, right? Like still, he then after the second museum burns down, he's like, I'm done. I'm done with museums. I am retiring.
Yo, fuck museums.
Yeah, well, he's 58, which is pretty old for that time, maybe.
Mm.
But anyways, he retires. But he was at this time also very, like I said before, very anti-outright fraud. He famously offered a $500 reward to any medium that could prove they were actually a medium.
Yeah, because he was only interested in the smalls and extra smalls.
Hey, you're only a smedium.
He testified against, there's that spirit photographer, William Mumbler, who was put on trial for fraud.
Yeah, quite hard to make out those photographs.
Mumbler, an audible. H.R. Mumbler. Mm. But he testified against this guy in court at his fraud trial. And his philosophy seems to be, again, from his writing, which can be trusted only, I don't know, 10%, but he seems very serious about, like, people should be entertained and not defrauded.
Mm-hmm. It's like, if defrauding them is part of the entertainment, that's fine, but they should come away with something.
They should come away like smiling, not frowning. You know, like, they shouldn't be feeling like they've been had. They should feel delighted.
Yeah. He's America's number one frown inverter by any means necessary.
Yeah. P.T. Barnum wearing the top hat with the Yankees Mets logo and the by any means necessary puffer jacket.
That's right. And he's releasing the Joker gas into the water supply.
All right. Well, I know what the first t-shirt's going to be.
That's right. We say that every episode.
Number one frown inverter.
I can't use the Supreme by any means necessary jacket on the first t-shirt for two podcasts.
No, I rebuke this. I'm rebuking you. So anyways, so he was actually fairly involved with politics. In 1854, he left the Democratic Party over their support of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which is some complicated 1854 politics shit. But basically what it did was it repealed the Missouri Compromise, led to Bleeding Kansas and all that. It was basically a pro-slavery act in Congress was the effect of it. And he joined the then-fledgling Republican Party because they were anti-slavery.
It's so funny that the Connecticut Republican Party is like, you go to what it is now and the founding member is like P.T. Barnum, you know?
Like, kind of. And now the Connecticut Republican Party is like, you know, maniacs only.
Howling maniacs.
Howling maniacs who are like, work at Chase Bank and don't want me to play the mind ball game. So, you know, he said during the signing of the 13th Amendment, a human soul that God has created and Christ died for is not to be trifled with. It may tenant the body of a Chinaman, a Turk, an Arab, or a Hottentot. It is still an immortal spirit.
That's the least racist you could be as a white guy in like the 1850s.
Like, for real. But he enters the Connecticut General Assembly.
Genuinely doing his best.
Yeah. I'm at the, like, you know, pre-war Republican convention. We've got a progressive stack. We're all doing the like finger snaps.
P.T. Barnum said famously, "Sight, don't bite." He entered the Connecticut General Assembly in 1865, representing the town of Fairfield, which is just next door to Bridgeport. And not much is available here about his tenure in the assembly. I was trying to read a bunch of this. He did not mention it in his autobiography that he was in the General Assembly for four terms, which of course was 3 years because 1865 is a nonsense time.
It's just a side hustle, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could say you wonder if he like tried to not mention it or just like he was like a kind of like a carpet bagging absentee.
I think maybe because he is in Europe a lot during this time.
With his two short guys.
His two short guys. Well, no, he's marrying his friend's daughter, which we'll get to. But he was in the legislature, for four terms for 3 years. He was the sponsor of the law that was overturned in the very famous Griswold v. Connecticut Supreme Court decision, making contraception illegal in Connecticut. Huh. That was him. Because he was, I think, he was one of those very like paternalistic kind of, I guess you'd call them like classical liberals. I don't know what you'd call them really, but like this sort of like philanthropist who is like, well, poor people don't know anything and I'm going to help them by entrapping them in a cage, you know?
Yeah, of course.
Like so much baboon.
A little bit like Peabody, an American financier who came to the UK and like started building social housing, but was like, of course, the social housing must be morally reinforcing.
If you wear a color other than black or gray, you get kicked out of the social housing kind of thing.
Yeah. Weirdly, still a huge property developer in the UK.
Huh.
Yeah, he never died.
Yeah, Peabody also was in Connecticut a bunch. He's got the museum at Yale is the Peabody. I'm assuming it's the same Peabody. If I'm wrong, don't write in.
Yeah, it's cool how all of these like weird guys left the like cultural imprint that we all still have to live in.
Uh-huh. At this point, he runs for Congress and loses to his own third cousin, William Henry Barnum.
Connecticut moment.
Uh-huh. It's real like, I think there's only seven guys at this time in history.
Mm-hmm. and five of them are like, yo, is that Tom Thumb?
Yeah. Like one of them's Tom Thumb. The other one is his Commodore Nut.
His autobiography here is pretty sketchy on the timeline, but after his assemblyship, he finally starts the thing we all know him for, the Barnum and Bailey Circus, which is like a big traveling show and hippodrome.
I've just Googled Commodore Nutt. Man, that's a tiny kid.
So here's the thing about the Barnum and Bailey Circus is that they were actually doing the fucking thing. Like all the people there were actually doing the acts that you saw, you know, there was like the freak show, which was evil and exploitative and bad, but like no one was getting scammed at the circus really. Right. Like you go to the circus and the acrobats are actually flipping around. Those elephants are real. You know, the lion tamer actually is interacting with a lion in front of you. Like it's a show. It's a real show. Mm.
I've found a little human tragedy in the first paragraph of Commodore Nutt's Wikipedia page.
Whoops.
So Nutt was in love with Lavinia Warren, who was also like performer at the museum, and she swerved him and married Tom Thumb, and Nutt had to be his best man and hated it and resented them both.
Yikes. I don't like that.
No.
That's sad. Yeah, oh man. Okay. Anyways, he's off in Europe during a lot of his time in the legislature.
Before we move on past like sort of like these guys, there is one kind of, it does end nicely in one way, which is that like they kept those two guys and the women they eventually like married did keep touring and got incredibly rich in their own right off of touring in like Europe and stuff.
Yes, Tom Thumb like died like a rich man.
Yeah, as did Commodore Nutt. They all ended up actually making quite a bit of money for themselves.
Yeah, which is at that point, Tom Thumb was like no longer under the thumb of Barnum. Like he was independent.
Yeah.
Which is like, I can't say the same thing about The Freak Show, which was called, and I'll repeat, The Freak Show. You know, but he's off in Europe a lot. And while he's in Europe, his wife dies. In his autobiography, he says that he just goes to England to chill with his bros for a month because he's so sad, but he doesn't go home and instead marries the daughter of his friend, John Fish, who owns a cotton mill in Manchester. So he marries Nancy Fish. And I looked into it. And unlike Lord Guppy, nobody here has invented the fish.
It's a shame.
She didn't discover that. It was all mermaids until Nancy Fish figured it out.
Yeah, it is. So now in his autobiography, it's 1875. He says that he was drafted to be the governor of Bridgeport by the local Republicans. He says that he doesn't even want it. He says that the local businessman nominated him and he thought it was a joke and checked with the Democrats locally and they said it was not a joke. So he said, okay, and then won in a landslide.
Man who is constantly thinking he's being pranked, you know? You prank me again, sir, by electing me mayor of Bridgeport.
You pranked me just like my grandfather pranked me.
Man who's been pranked two times in his life and is like constantly vigilant for more.
Yeah. Also, that's an amazing thing from like
doesn't
the 19th
know what a prank
century.
Is. First prank, get inherit a swamp. Second prank, become mayor. Neither of those is really a prank. One of them actually just isn't. And he's like, I understand what a prank is and nothing is changing that understanding.
Yet another practical joke of which I have been the victim, says the mayor of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
They call me Practical Joke T-Barnum.
Also, so this is a very cool thing, but it's like, hey, it's the 19th century. You can just be made mayor of a place without really trying to be.
How to become mayor without really trying. Yeah. I love that book.
You can't let the electorate think you really want to be mayor. You have to go in and be like, oh, nice town. Nice town, I guess, for somewhere that's this close to the swamp. And then they're going to try to make you like them.
I'm going to drain my own swamp. I think it speaks to the sort of attitude around like being a politician at this time, right? Like it was just sort of like literally like civil service. If you were rich enough, like you should just go do it for a little while in this like paternalistic way, right? So anyways, but as mayor, he serves from 1875 to 1876. His main concerns as mayor seem to be adding gas lamps to the city streets and enforcing blue laws.
And then he would turn down the gas lamps and say to the residents of Bridgeport, what are you talking about? They're still at maximum brightness.
That's correct. Connecticut to this day has really massively oppressive blue laws, like anti-liquor laws. And he was him and his ilk were responsible for a lot of this. He engages in a lot of what he calls, quote, profitable philanthropy.
This is Darren Lyons. That's just what Darren Lyons was trying to do, but he didn't have... He didn't have the grounding that P.T. Barnum did. He never had no follow through.
I mean, if P.T. Barnum had access to fake abs, who knows what he could have done? You know, he spends a lot of money and time improving like the infrastructure and beautifying Bridgeport. Like he builds a road through his own property that'll help people out. He co-founds the ferry company that still runs to this day between Bridgeport and Port Jeff on Long Island. And he's, you know, his whole thing is like, I'm going to make Bridgeport a city, which he kind of does do. because you can't do that if you're just a rich guy. At this point, he gets his circus off the ground, not his surface, circus. He becomes very obsessed with building a Roman hippodrome in New York City, which he also does.
Megalopolis again.
He's Caesar Catalina in a lot of ways.
Mm.
He like builds an actual hippodrome where every night there is like a parade of nations and horse racing. In his autobiography, he talks so much more about what goes on at this fucking thing than he does about being mayor. He talks about being mayor for 2 seconds. He talks about hanging out with the king of the Sandwich Islands at the hippodrome for like 10 minutes. He's so cool. People seemed very easy to entertain back then, I guess. He then, of course, causes an international incident trying to get Jumbo the elephant from England. The elephant doesn't want to leave the zoo and they have to trick it. It's really horrible. There's this story that he relays in his autobiography about like having to trick the elephant into getting into a rolling cage was like the worst thing I've ever heard, and such horrible mistreatment of the animals. And everyone in England is like, oh no, Jumbo, the biggest elephant in captivity. We love you so much. Why'd you sell him to P.T. Barnum, the zoo?
It's because they did austerity.
Mm.
Yeah,
yep.
Maybe.
Yeah, original austerity.
Is it really?
Yep.
That's wow. Why.
They're like, we're selling. It's like, you know, we're allowed to have publicly owned elephants. They just have to be owned by another country.
Yeah. Would you nationalize elephants?
Doing elephant diplomacy.
I absolutely would nationalize elephants. Yes. Thank you for asking.
That's right. This is just a little fun fact that I think about a lot, is that at this point he becomes a board member of Tufts University in Boston. And when Jumbo dies, the corpse ends up at the college, and which I think the corpse burned in a fire, but the football team at Tufts is still to this day called the Jumbos, which
it bizarre how these things shake out, you know? Yeah.
Like because he was like an original trustee.
It's fun to have a football team basically called the Big Fellas. That's pretty good.
The Tufts Big Boys. So at this point, it is towards the end of his life. A mayor lived, mayor lived. And he, on his deathbed, asks the paper to print his obituary early so he can read it before he died.
Okay, that's kind of a cool move.
Which he then read and then died.
must not have liked it.
Yeah, it's he ended up actually being in that vaudeville show called Bridgeport, where an oyster seller guy who got really rich owning a lot of oyster cellars was like, hey, can you cameo in my mockumentary play about Bridgeport?
PC like, Bonham getting into a carriage.
Yeah, okay, how about this? I'll lend you my really awesome carriage with it's drawn by a Mustang horse that you have to like take to Chicago in order to give to your simpleton cousin who's visiting from Portugal. How about that?
But yeah, that's PT, which he lives a sort of like, I think he's interesting because he lives a sort of like Forrest Gumpy existence of the 19th century.
I feel like I've just watched Barry Lyndon.
A little bit.
Let's fold him into our larger theory of mayors, right?
Yeah.
Which is that I think the theory of mayors here with P.T. Barnum is that he was an odd and obsessive man, and so people who could make him mayor sort of conspired to do so. The fact that he had no desire to be mayor was immaterial. He was clearly a mayor waiting for office.
He was mayor material.
Yeah. He was mayor material.
He might have also wanted to be mayor and just had to lie about it because it was like considered gauche to want to be a politician in America for a really long time.
Yeah.
In fairness, it would be a fantastic prank to get any of us elected as mayor of anything.
I think that would... Okay, don't do that, first of all. No one is allowed to do that.
Been pranked again.
Okay, if readers of this show, if listeners of this show want to somehow conspire to make me the mayor of New York City, I'd like to see it happen. If you could do it, I'll take it.
The current mayor of Bridgeport, I looked into this before we did the recording, like the guy Joe Ganim spent 7 years in prison before being reelected on like federal corruption charges.
It's most normal mid-sized New England city mayor. Like,
yeah,
fully. Like, we'll get to Buddy Cianci one day, as we will do every mayor. But like I think it was just like Bridgeport did have it's also like weird rise and fall as a city. Like now it is sort of like a post-industrial struggling place, and it was basically because of people like Barnum was very prosperous for a long time. But like, what's that built on the back of is sad to think about.
I have one little factoid about P.T. Barnum that I want to end with. I have no idea if this is true. There are a lot of things said and written about him which are not true, including that he coined the phrase, there's a sucker born every minute, which is, as far as I know, not one of his. However, I like this story. This is about the American Museum. He noticed that people were like staying too long in the museum. And so he had signs put up saying, to the egress. And people not knowing what an egress is were like, I don't know. I assume it's some kind of big bird or something. I'm going to go see the egress and find themselves outside.
But you know what? They were entertained.
That's right. Yeah.
They were smiling.
They were smiling the whole way.
Oh, boy. I loved this one. This one's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I do think he is an interesting, he does kind of slot into like the history of the mayor as a thing in an interesting way, just in terms of his like sort of his relationship to the truth,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yes. Yeah.
Slippery guy.
And a showman, as we said, and that's something that being a mayor particularly lends yourself to, you know?
Yeah.
It's a good job for a showman in a way that even other politicians' jobs might not be.
That's right. You're forcing a showman to be an administrator, and some showmen rise to the occasion better than others.
Yeah, like name recognition will get you to the mayorship pretty easily, it seems like. But once you're there, you better be operating the gas lamps correctly.
Or incorrectly, as the case may be.
Or incorrectly, but not telling me about it.
Another beautiful mayor.
Another mayor
story.
In the books. Right, we close the book of mayors until next week.
Our next mayor, I believe.
I'm excited for the next mayor. Our first standalone bonus mayor.
Ooh. Yes, we have gotten Shanti Singh on to talk about gruesome Gavin Newsom.
That's right, baby. Ooh. I'm going to be talking about the first wine American mayor, and I'm very excited.
Thank you for listening to the free feed that'll be next week on the Patreon, nogodsnomayors.com, $5 a month.
Wait, what? Nogodsnomayors.com is our Patreon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it redirects?
You didn't know we registered that? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Riley, this has been the case for 3 months.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Check out nogodsnomayors.com.
This way to the mayors.
Hey, everybody, to the egress.
okay.
Raising my glass to the egress.
All right, to the egress of all of us. Bye, everybody.
Bye.